Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm very happy to have you with me today for this conversation that I'll be sharing with you with Sarah Napick. She is someone who initially came to me as an integration client, and we had a number of conversations over a number of months and did a lot of work together, and she's also a BUFO facilitator. And we just have a very interesting conversation to share with all of you, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that in just a minute. But first, let's just get some announcements out of the way. There have not been any donations in support of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast over this past week, so I don't have anybody to thank there, but I do have two special people that I would like to thank this week. This week, my thanks goes out to David and Jacqueline, both of whom are hosting a retreat this upcoming week and have invited me to be a sort of guest co-facilitator with them. It is not my retreat. I am definitely an adjunct of being added into this, and I've been very much enjoying working with the retreat participants thus far. We've been gathering together on Zoom calls and getting to know everyone, and I'm really looking forward to participating in this and working as someone to help people prepare and navigate their experiences and also integrate them, and working on somatic exercises and energetic embodiment and all of that. I'm really excited. So I'm going to be out of the office this coming week. That's what I will be doing. And actually, I'm going to be uploading the next edition of the podcast immediately after I upload this one, because I will be away, so I want that up and ready to go. But of course, I am always available for integration calls for all of you out there who would like to do that, but we'll just have to schedule something for after I get back from the retreat. Of course, you want more information about that, go to nondualentheogenicintegration.com. I'm available for 30, 60, and 90-minute calls, and I'm happy to get you on the schedule, even though I will be out of the office for a week or so. But great big thanks to David and Jacqueline for bringing me on for this. I'm really looking forward to it. I've actually personally never participated in a retreat of any kind in my life, so this is like brand new in that sense. Certainly in the medicine retreat world. And I'm just really looking forward to it. And I wanted to make an offer to you, the listening audience, which is part of the offer that I made to the retreat participants, that people were looking for music to help support them in their journeys. And so I made a couple of my albums available for free download over at my Bandcamp page. And I'm going to be putting those back to $10 per album. But if you're listening to this, and if it is a Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, I'm leaving midday on Wednesday, I will be changing it back to $10 for the albums. But if you want to go over to martinball.bandcamp.com, you can grab either my, or both. You could grab The Fate of Mirani, the soundtrack, or The Pure Energy of Unconditional Love. So the way that that works over at Bandcamp is that you go and select the album to download, and it will ask you for a payment. And because I've set it for free, all you need to do is enter zero, and then you can download that for free. So if you get this, if you're listening to this in the next couple days before I change it back, you're welcome to grab a free album for yourself. Now, let me tell you what we've got going here with this interview with Sarah Napick. So we originally recorded an interview, it's a couple months ago now, and we talked for almost 2 hours. So it was already kind of a long interview. And then Sarah's situation changed again in a surprising and unexpected way. And it felt like releasing the interview as it was would certainly be, at the very least, out of date and incomplete. So we decided that we would do another short interview to kind of bring everything up to date, because it had been a while since we had done the original interview. And so basically we have two different interviews. One is much longer, one is shorter. But what I've done is I took the original interview and I cut it about in half or so, because it was already almost 2 hours. And what I've decided to do is, rather than have all of Sarah's interview come out this week, is we're going to have the first half is this week. And then next week, rather than having the next chapter from the Facilitating 5-MeO-DMT anthology, I'm going to go ahead and release the second half of the interview with Sarah. So we're going to have 2 weeks of Sarah back to back. And then after that, we will have the next chapter from Facilitating 5-MeO. Okay, so that's the way that this is going to work, and we really cover quite a bit of territory. We talk about Sarah's own experiences, her own life trajectory, what she came to me for integration work and reflection, her own practice of serving Bufo, and eventually how she decided to walk away from that, and then decided to return. And as we discuss in the interview, one of the things that we initially had discussed bringing her on to have a conversation around was that she was feeling inspired to create a Bufo church. And then that also went away, and now it's kind of come back. And so it's not established yet, but that was part of the motivation for us to do the interview originally. So we cover a lot of territory, talk about a lot of different stuff, and it's going to cut off in the middle at a place that seemed like a reasonable place to pause the interview. But just know that there will be more next week with Sarah, and hopefully they're relatively balanced in terms of how long each interview is. Okay, so let's go ahead and get to it. Here's my interview with Sarah Napick discussing her journey into Bufo and her own integration work and her own facilitation, and then more next week. Okay, thanks for listening. Okay, well, I am welcoming on to the Entheogenic Evolution podcast today, Sarah Napick. And Sarah comes to us today with a very interesting story. So I'm just going to give a little bit of background, then I'm going to turn it over to Sarah, and she's going to tell us all about it. But Sarah and I have been working together over many of the past months. I'm not quite sure how long. Do you remember when we first started doing consultations?
I think back in like October or so. Okay. Like last fall. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been a good long while. And you were someone who came to me as a Bufo facilitator and wanting feedback on your experiences and your own integration and work with clients. And so we did a lot of work there. And we had talked about having you on as a guest to talk about your work. And also you were kind of moving into feeling inspired around the idea of creating an entheogenic church. And then things took a drastic turn for you in a different direction. And I think it makes for just a fascinating story and something that's worthwhile to share, because ultimately, so I'm going to give away the ending, but I'm going to let you give all the details. But you decided to walk away from facilitating Bufo and facilitating medicine experiences in general. And I'm kind of excited about it because, I mean, you're doing this for different reasons, but other than myself, I don't know if I've ever talked to someone who has worked as a facilitator and then decided I'm done with this and decided to walk away. For me, the decision was built around that I felt that I had learned what I was going to learn from facilitating, and I wanted to share about that in a different way. And also just it's a lot of work, and again feeling, well, I've learned what I'm going to learn and now I want to share what I've learned. So that was my motivation. Your motivation is rather different, but I still think it makes for a very interesting story, and maybe one that we don't hear enough of in the psychedelic world, because everybody wants to be a facilitator, everybody wants to serve medicine, but that's not the direction you've gone in. So Sarah, welcome to the show. I've given away a little bit, but let's start just by getting to know you, Sarah. But first, yeah, welcome. It's wonderful to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So Sarah, maybe let's just start with your personal background. And here, you know, you're welcome to be as open as you want about, you know, where you've come from and what your experience has been and, you know, single mom, co-parenting, all of that. So yeah, I just invite you to, let's start with getting to know Sarah, and then we'll get into all the work with the medicine and then the walking away.
Alrighty. Well, I feel like my journey of really discovering who I am started about 5.5 years ago when I decided to leave my marriage. I was definitely kind of living the programmed life. I was married. I had 2 kids. I owned the beautiful house in the hills. And during that time, I was just very unhappy and resentful and didn't enjoy my life, and often pushed love away from my husband and my children. And it just like really felt like something was missing. At that time, I had stopped working and I was a full-time mom, just teaching yoga part-time on the side. And I was deeply unhappy. I spent a year on Zoloft, and thought when my son goes to kindergarten, that would be a good opportunity for me to taper off. And instead of tapering off, I wasn't educated enough to know that there was like a very specific tapering off process for that type of a medicine. And I was like, oh, my son's in kindergarten. I'm going to cut my pill in half and then I'm going to stop taking it. And that's what I did. And I had a rather drastic breakdown. And there was a moment that my husband had come home. I had a 2 and a 5-year-old, 2 boys at the time, and I had locked them out of the house. I was completely having a meltdown. And I was like, I think I've lost my mind. And something pivotal happened there. I went down and took a bath, and it was the first time that I had felt myself, maybe ever in a long time. I don't know. It was a feeling that I hadn't really felt before. And in that one moment, this like truth bomb hit so hard that I had been suppressing and ignoring and escaping. And that was, I want a divorce.
So I guess I'm going to put a label on it. So I'm sorry, but it sort of sounds like maybe sort of the classic case of self-abandonment. And I think that this tends to be an issue more for women than it is for men. But this idea of, well, I've checked the boxes. I'm married, got kids, got a home. I should be happy. I'm not happy. But it sounds like maybe you weren't really, really feeling yourself, and kind of you put your head down and, oh, I'm going to take the Zoloft and just kind of power through. But there was some self-abandonment in there. Does that sound...
It definitely resonates. I don't think I even like really fully had a relationship with myself maybe before that. I mean, maybe a little bit, but I also think it was just like so much programming of like, this is what you're supposed to do. And I was really young. You know, I got married at 27 and had my first kid at 29 and my second kid at 32. So it was just like, just everything really fast. I'm like, okay, I got the life I'm supposed to have. And it was like, what's missing here? And it was me. I was missing. So yeah, total self-abandonment.
Oh. So then you took a bath, which, you know, is a nice way to literally feel yourself. I mean, literally you're in the warm water, you're feeling that. And that sounds like a hard realization to come to, but maybe also happy at the same time. I don't know. How would you describe it?
I mean, I was just like, wow, how do I navigate out of this life that I've created? I think there was a lot of relief that I was finally willing to be completely truthful with myself about how I was feeling instead of just smoking a lot of weed and taking Zoloft to suppress everything. It was a liberating time. At that time, I decided I would no longer be called by my married name. I would only be called by my maiden name. And I took off my wedding ring. Wow. And I spent the next 4 months. This was in September. I spent September. Yeah, like 4 to 5 months convincing my husband to divorce me.
So what was his reaction?
I mean, like, he blamed it on the Zoloft, right? Everybody blamed what was going on with me on the Zoloft. My family, my friends, him. And, like, we had a sweet partnership. He was a great man. It was just something just wasn't right there. And I think I hadn't found myself yet. And I needed to leave and find myself. And I feel like that was the biggest leap of faith I've ever taken, because I had, like, all the security and stability one could ever want. But, like, it was truly deeply missing self-love and intuition and connection. And that was like my first big leap of faith. Like, even though everything looked so great in my life, I left it and decided I would figure it all out and left all the security I could have ever wanted, which I've like definitely a lot of times been like, what was I thinking? But you know, I know I'm going where I'm supposed to be. And that was like my first time of learning how to trust myself. And like, okay, this is the direction I need to go. Like, I have to allow the universe to show up here and take the one step forward, which is to get a new house. It's like one step at a time.
Yeah. Well, it's a very good illustration of just the reality that loving yourself, respecting yourself, caring for yourself doesn't mean it's all going to be easy choices or that things are just going to go your way. You know, that there's a lot of spiritual fluffiness around that. It's like, once you love yourself, everything's going to be so easy and everything's just going to fall into place. And that's just not how reality works. That's just another story we like to tell ourselves.
It's a story. I think you can start to see a shift of like, okay, these really challenging situations are happening for my growth instead of going into being a victim when challenging situations happen.
Yeah.
But they're going to happen no matter how much you love yourself, how present you are, whatever's happening in your life. Like that's how we grow.
Yeah. And just that claiming of that truth of, look, if I'm going to love and care for myself, it's up to me to do it. And it might mean reaching beyond the security of what I feel I've developed for myself. And yeah, going beyond sort of these markers of married kids. And, you know, I went through the same thing in my first marriage where when it really hit me, like, look, if I want a more fulfilling life, I'm going to have to do it. No, you know, I kept waiting for somebody else to do it for me or for reality to do it for me.
Right.
Yeah.
Nope. It's all us. We have to make the first step every time.
Yeah. So that was a brave and difficult and challenging and liberating. I'm sure it was like scary and exciting all at the same time.
It was. I mean, there was a lot of momentum and like it was really beautiful how I was provided for and I was able to find a new home in the Bay Area in Oakland where I am, which is very challenging. And like things, a new business idea came through, like a new life showed itself to me and I was able to set that up. But the pain of breaking up a family was something that I worked very hard on healing and it was very challenging.
Yeah. And I'm just curious, how about your parents? What did they think of all that?
Oh my gosh. I think I ruined my dad's life in that moment. My parents were pretty upset and definitely lost some friends as well. Yeah, that's still a pain in my dad and I's relationship that I left my marriage. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which, you know, it's one of these other sort of challenging examples that other people are really always trying to hold us to their expectations and their projections of who we should be or are supposed to be. And if we reach outside of that it becomes a breach within the relationship because we're not conforming to their ideals anymore.
It is. And that's like, that's still in the relationship that I am with him. And it's sad. Like the more I am myself, it feels like the breach just gets deeper and deeper, but that was the first big breach. And I think that was like the first time that I had actually left his idea for my life and decided I was going to choose for myself. So it was like, I didn't only divorce my husband that time. I felt like I had divorced my father too, because I started living my life for myself for the first time at 35.
Yeah. So it's bittersweet, isn't it? That you have that feeling of self-satisfaction of you're caring for yourself, you're taking actions for yourself. And then the people who quote unquote love us don't necessarily understand. And that's where we find really quickly that actually most human relationship love is conditional. It's not unconditional. It's not, oh, Sarah, I love you, whatever you do. I'm going to support you, whatever you do. But like, Sarah, what are you doing? You're ruining your life. You're ruining your family.
There was a moment that I even went to my dad and I said, do you still love me? Because it didn't feel like it. And there was no support there. It was actually the complete opposite, a removal of any support there. And I was like, do you still love me? He said he still loved me, but of course he was very upset. But you know what? Like, they don't know how to love conditionally, so I'm not going to be upset with him.
Yeah, well, that's good. And it's also one of these truths that it's not your responsibility.
It's not. My responsibility is myself.
Yeah, yeah. So then in making this new life for yourself, you said you started a new business venture. What was that?
Yeah, it was sweet. You know, at the end of my marriage, I took this week-long self-love meditation retreat, which I don't think I'd really ever meditated before, even though I've been like a yoga teacher for so long, at Esalen. And it was so beautiful there. I was so inspired by the coast of Big Sur and the gardens. And there's an art barn. And I wandered through there thinking that I would create I don't know, some type of painting or something. And there was a wreath frame. And then I spent the next couple days creating this insanely beautiful wreath from all the trimmings and flowers and succulents from their garden. And it was so stunning that people asked me if I was there to teach a class on it as I was walking back to my room. And Eslon even took it for photos. And I came home and it was symbolic for me because I was like, I'm looking for a new home. You know, I came home from that within like a month. I had moved out of our family home, got my own house, and I hung the wreath on the door. And as I watched everything kind of wither and die, the succulents lived. And then I ended up having a succulent design business, making gorgeous wreaths and arrangements for 4 years and shipping them around the U.S. And yeah, and just the way that all rolled out was just, it was like handed to me, like, here's what you do next.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was really cool to discover a creative talent that I didn't know I had yet.
Yeah. And this participation in the retreat is, you mentioned that you hadn't been into meditation before. Was this kind of a new thing for you to like sign up for a retreat and go to something like this?
Yeah, it was a new thing for me. And I needed a break really, really badly at that time. And then it helped me implement a meditation practice, but it was a very challenging retreat having to meditate for that many hours a day when you've never meditated before. Like I would have other people be like, I was watching you having a very hard time settle. Like I definitely had to like learn how to calm down and sit still. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you still practice some meditation?
I do. Yeah. I've had a morning practice for a long time. It's a little bit off right now since I got my puppy because now I wake up and take her out and she goes to the park and we throw the ball. But it shifted a little bit from like sitting up and sitting down to like observing what's happening in my mind the first thing when I wake up and spending time in my bed with my mind.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So you mentioned previously that in addition to the Zoloft, you were using cannabis. So is that something that shifted or you carried with you into the new life, or how did was there a reorientation around that?
I think that cannabis has kind of been one of those friends that I've, that I kind of come in and out of through the years. I think I'm finally to the place now where I don't feel like I need to work with cannabis anymore. I think it was really helpful for me in a lot of ways and also hurtful in some ways. Because I couldn't sleep at night if I wasn't smoking it. And I tend to want to spend a lot more time on my own. Yeah, and that it, I would feel like when I would smoke it, I'd be so connected to my intuition and have ideas flowing, but I wasn't able to kind of, you know, use that energy to move forward and create anything because I just wanted to keep smoking it. So I haven't been smoking it now since like March. Yeah, and that feels really good. And my sleep is re-regulating and I don't have to go do something like that all the time anymore.
Yeah, great. So yeah. When did other plant medicines make their way into your world? How did that start?
Yeah, it was shortly after I left the marriage. I had asked a friend at the yoga studio, like, do you know of any meditation retreats that I need to get out of town this weekend? And she was like, I don't have a meditation retreat, but I know somewhere where you can go do ayahuasca. And I was like, And I'd done psychedelics before, but not in a medicinal ceremonial setting. And I kind of thought about it and I was like, I'd like to try it. So I went and tried ayahuasca and started sitting with that medicine, a good couple of times for a little bit there. And then that place burned down and some of the fires that we had down in Boulder Creek was very sad. And in that time period, I met a woman who runs a Wachuma church and I started sitting with her. And then kind of shortly during our time together, I started helping her in ceremony and assisting her. And this time, like ayahuasca is just out of my life. I'm just kind of with the Wachuma right now, like just healing all the stuff from my marriage, seeing my patterns and my programming and all the things that I didn't have awareness of before and ways I would cover up being myself or funny ways I was showing up and just getting an insight into who I was, you know, having really not gotten to know myself before. And then one day, one woman showed up to our Wachuma circle and she happened to serve the toad. And I was like, I want to try it. So I did.
Well, just to put a pause on it for a second, maybe before we shift to toad, I'm just curious that you mentioned a lot of very interesting sort of revelations and insights in the work with Wachuma. I'm curious if there's any particular experiences that stand out for you that maybe you could share sort of to illustrate how some of these things came to you. Because I think that these are really wonderful insights. And I think that these are things that a lot of people encounter when, as you say, sort of doing different work, sort of this self-exploration work with entheogens versus, well, you know, I tried psychedelics and had a good time or whatever. But I'm curious how some of these insights came to you and what you confronted or resolved within these experiences and processed them. So if there's anything you'd want to share there.
Yeah, I mean, I can reverse back to my first Aya experience. I think that was the first time that I had come fully into the concept of self-love. Yeah, she was super gentle with me, and I just got to experience like a sweet love. I don't know that I had really experienced that before because love in my house was very conditional, and it was always taken away for things. So I'd never just felt like I can be who I am and make mistakes and mess up and still be loved. And I got to realize that I can do that for myself through my Aya experience. And with Wachuma, you know, it's just like a sweet medicine. It opened up my heart a lot and softened me so much. Like, definitely used to be more of an angry person and yell, and like, that's just like not my demeanor anymore.
Yeah. And, I would never have imagined
just, oh my
and,
gosh,
and all of our interactions. I never would have thought, oh yeah, Sarah, she's a yeller.
I spent 2 years in anger management therapy when I came out of my marriage.
Wow.
Not anger management, but just like, it was like I got to see how my parents were and like how I picked it up and how I was just continuing on what I had learned. And it was really important to me that I did not pass this on to my children. Like, I had to stop with me. And it's beautiful because, you know, my son was 5 when we split, and now he's 11. And he's like gotten to watch me grow up, and he reflects all the time. He'll say, like, when a situation will arise, and he'll see how I handle it. And he's like, wow, Mom, you did such a good job. Had that happened a couple of years ago, you would have gotten so upset. So it's sweet that he gets to see the growth too. And that, like, that's never my go-to now.
Absolutely. That is so beautiful. I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because I mean, that's something that I don't know your dad. I've never spoken with your dad, but that's something that I wish he could see and kind of understand that's, again, when people are sort of holding us to, this is my preconceived notion of what you are supposed to be and how you're supposed to look like, that would have perpetuated the angry, resentful version of Sarah. And there never would have been this moment of your son being able to see this difference and be able to compare it to what he's seen before and recognize there's been growth in you and know that it comes from you working on yourself, versus if you just stayed in the marriage, what he probably would have seen is the growth of the angry, resentful energy. Oh. And then he would have learned that, then taken that into his relationships. And so now he has a completely different model to work from. And that is what self-love and caring for the self and giving yourself permission, that's what it imparts to others, is that knowledge that transformation is possible, self-love is possible. I can be myself.
Yeah. And it's sweet. And if I do mess up a little bit, like, we have quick mends, you know, like, I'm like, I'm sorry, you know, and him too, because he has that fire in him. So we just work with it, you know, and they're actually off to visit my parents in Maine. They'll be there on Saturday. They're on the East Coast right now with their dad. And we kind of talked about it before they went. And he's like, well, you know, he's just going to yell at us. So, like, that's already going to happen. Because I was like, keep in touch with me. I want to hear how things are going. Yeah. He's like, well, you know, he's going to yell at us. So, like, yeah, not expecting anything different there. But, like, yeah, with me, it's not like that anymore. So super grateful for those shifts, and just to backtrack to your question, offering one of my, I think, most potent insights from Wachuma was, it was on Wachuma that I first got to understand that I'm God and God is me. I had not seen that before. And I was like, wow. It was such a beautiful revelation. It wasn't embodied instantly. I didn't know quite what to do with it. It took a long time for that to embody. And a lot of my work with Bufo, which I know we'll talk about, but yeah, it was the most potent insight and the first time I had received it.
Yeah. So here's just where I want to back up even further and just ask you about your own upbringing, because you know, this is a fundamental insight that
I knew this question was coming.
Yeah. But I'm curious. So, I mean, not just this idea, but the experience of this kind of this grand revelation, right? The veils are pulled away and like, oh, I am that, this infinite, eternal, whatever, God, goddess, whatever we want to call it. I am that. And it is me. It is what I am in my truest nature. This is something that obviously most mainstream religions don't teach. A lot of spiritualities touch on this, but then they wrap it in a lot of mythology and whatnot and meaning making. So here's just sort of the raw deal. So for you, what kind of background did you come from? And did this, was this like a sort of a new revelation, or was like, oh, this is what I've been taught, or this isn't what I was taught at all? So I'm just curious, what was the background story there?
Yeah, it was definitely not anything I had ever been taught before. That's why when it like hit like it did, I was like, wow, I wish I had known this sooner, which is beautiful because I'm teaching this to my children at a young age, you know. But I grew up in Southern California in Orange County, and we'd moved a bit as a kid, but I grew up with like two emotionally unavailable parents. My mom is from Scotland and came to Scotland, and like there's been a lot of alcoholism in her family. So I grew up with my mom as an alcoholic with multiple suicide attempts. And obviously that's extremely challenging. And the withdrawing that she continuously perpetuated in our relationship is very hard for me. And I created those patterns later, of course. And a lot of times when she wouldn't speak to me, I would write her a letter to try to get her to love me again, you know. And then my dad would come into my room and be like, this is a very good letter, good job. And then my mom would like make amends with me. And we were like in a pattern like that. So then that ended up perpetuating like this like special thing that I needed to be, because like writing that letter made me special. And then you get special, then you get love. It's just like looking back is like everything, you know, how it rolled out later. And my dad, like we went on vacations, like things were sweet, but these were just the things that were happening in the household, you know. Yeah. My dad had a fuse and a temper and an anger, and he yelled at me a lot. So like if someone yells at me, like I shut down instantly now. And I mean, people don't really yell at me anymore, and I'm able to now say I can't have be in a conversation like that. But yeah, as a child, like just getting yelled at by one parent and having another parent not speak to me, like it was challenging. Yeah, and we like went to church sometimes, and I was Catholic kind of, you know, but yeah, nothing about God, nothing about intuition, not trust yourself. Everything was fear, scarcity, programming. You do it this way, this is how it's done, you know. And that was how I ended up in the life that I ended up in, because that was how you do it. That was what I was told to do. My parents told me, and I just had not like woken up enough yet to realize there's a different way. And like even looking back and seeing sometimes my marriage, the way my dad would still hold me down and like wanting to get a part-time job and then needing some help with my kids, and him saying, well, I'll come help you with your kids, but only if you quit your job.
Wow.
Yeah. So like it's really interesting to look back and just see like, what did you want me to be? Like I got to the point where like, I don't want to pick up the dry cleaning anymore. Like, I don't want to do this. I'm so much more.
Yeah. So in that experience with the Wachuma, and you experience yourself as God, goddess, the union of identities. I'm just curious if you could tell us a little bit more about the event itself that you'd want to share.
Yeah, I mean, it just showed me that it was all one thing, one energy, and that there wasn't a separation or a difference between us. Yeah. And I just remember, like, I was actually alone during this time period on Wachuma. I think I'd taken it with my teacher, I was telling you about, and we were just at my house before we were having ceremony the next day. And I think she had fallen asleep and I was still up, and this was all coming through. I'm like, oh my gosh. And in that moment, it had given me this beautiful image of a tattoo that I ended up getting, you know, a year and a half later. That's the logo for my business now, of just like one side of the heart is me. One side of the heart is God. And together we are one heart, and God speaks through us through our heart. That's where the intuition is.
Beautiful. I'm curious. Did anyone tell you to expect that? I'm just curious if there was any like priming, or was it just sort of out of the blue?
No, nobody told me. Like, yeah, we talk about Creator and Great Spirit. And I don't think in my circle or community, like, the word God was really being used yet. Mm-hmm. I was definitely the first to come forward talking about God and seeing the way that people reacted and were triggered from that word. And that was like, you know, that comes next in the next part of our conversation. But yeah, no. Because even though everybody's doing their medicine work and like doing the best they can, they're healing up their lives, that you're only where you can be, and you might still be wrapped up in your own beliefs. So I think it's like something we kind of need to learn on our own.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a great example of how you certainly were not indoctrinated with that belief or that idea as a child growing up. You weren't necessarily overly exposed to it, but that it came to you after you took the steps to love and care for yourself. So that I think that that's where the correlation
is. I love that reflection. Thank you. Yeah. That'll match up with something later in the story that I want to share, that it's like, it's always a two-parted scenario. We do our part, God does God's part. Like, they always come together, and it takes two, both sides.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing all of that. So then I know you wanted to jump into, then someone came and said, I've got toad. So let's go ahead and move into that.
Yeah, someone came along and I went and sat with toad for the first time. And I remember doing the little microdose, and like, I'd already done a lot of medicine, but I did that little microdose and I was like, whoa, I don't know if I could do this, which is the problem with the microdose.
Yeah.
But I was like, I'm going to do it. And I did my full dose. And it was a beautiful experience. I got to really connect with a lot of pain still from the family and the divorce that were still present. And I think my early work with the medicine was healing up the end of my marriage and my divorce. But it was in the first time that I'd ever received the medicine that I felt like I was wanted to serve it. And I know that that's common, which I didn't know then, but all I knew was like, I'm not telling anybody this. Like, I kept that to myself for a lot of reasons, you know, a lot of like, who am I, to a lot of insecurity, unworthiness, you know, whatever. But I wanted to go right back and try it again shortly after, and I did.
Yeah. I'm curious, what are your thoughts on precisely what you've just described, this phenomenon, which seems to be potentially more common with 5-MeO-DMT / Buvo secretions more than anything else, where people have an experience with it and there is almost this overwhelming urge, like, I want to share this with others. What are your thoughts on where, why, how that arises? What makes that so common, in your opinion?
That's such a good question. I think it's just this, such a different feeling than we've ever experienced before. And the healing is so profound and deep in a short amount of time that I think I wanted other people to experience it. And then, like, on the flip side of that coin, like if you want to go serve ayahuasca or, you know, you're going to be in dietist for years and very long training and, you know, and Bufo doesn't have that, which I think there's a beauty to that because it lets people present it as they are. And then there's also, you know, of course, a dark side to that, that some people shouldn't be serving it who can have it and serve it. So, yeah, I don't know. It's what are your thoughts? It's a great question.
Yeah. Well, for me, from my first full experience, and you know, I always distinguish this, that I had some experience with 5-MeO-DMT before I had the full experience. But once I had the full experience, yeah, my immediately thought was, I want everybody in the world to experience this because it was so different than any prior entheogenic experience I'd ever had. And it just presented as it was the answer in the sense that this experience is what I've been looking for my entire life, but didn't even know that this was what I was looking for, that I couldn't have told you.
No.
Yeah. But now that I've had the experience and just that full resonance of truth, like this is it. This is what humanity, not just me, Martin, but this is what humanity is looking for. And it does present as very easy in a sense, right? This isn't going to commit me to, you know, studying under a shaman for 10 years or going through all the diets and all of that. It's so easy. You load the pipe and you give it to someone and they have this experience. And also I would say from that first full experience I had, I was very naive because since I just went all the way into infinite non-duality, pure unconditional love, my impression was this is the way it's going to work for anyone.
Right.
And it took a little while. It took more observation to realize that's not,
it's not the truth.
Yeah. That's not the truth.
Yeah. And I just, to that point, like, the energetic growth that has to happen to hold that medicine and carry that medicine is almost equatable to going and doing all the diets and studying with the shaman, because like you have to hold yourself in a certain way to be able to cleanly serve that medicine. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the work is going to still get done. You might be able to like go get the medicine quicker, but like, the inner work has to still get, you know, into a good place.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I would say that for myself, that initiated just a complete process of deconstruction and reconstruction of myself before I ever actually considered like serving it to anybody else.
Yeah, I think mine kind of happened a little bit side by side. Like I was already in a pretty good place, but yeah, I mean, it's interesting now having this conversation with you, having spoken with you for months. I'm seeing a lot of parallels for you and I.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, and I was just going to say something. Oh, and I lost it. What was it? There was something along these lines I was going to say. Oh, it'll come back in a moment. But just as soon as you said there's a lot of parallels, they all suddenly lined up in my head. It's like, yeah, I know. It's kind of interesting how many that there are. Maybe it'll come back to me. Yes, this is it. The other side of the, I want to serve this. I want to share this with everyone. That another side of the ego then comes out that you mentioned of, well, who am I? Mm. Like, what makes me worthy? And that's, so we have, there's both the overassessment of the ego that says, oh, I can do this. And then the underassessment that says, who am I? I'm not worthy. I wonder if you could share a little bit more about what that was for you, because that's the difficult egoic side. Well, one of the difficult egoic sides of that non-dual experience, that experience of being the infinite, of being identified with that, is that then the ego comes back and says, well, I can't even tell anyone that, because if I even say that, I'm going to sound egotistical. And so that the ego recoils at that. And then especially if you start using the word God, then other people get in there like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like you've really overstepped.
Right.
Now, that's the negative egoic reaction. I'm curious if you could unpack that a little bit more from your own experience.
Yeah, I can. And I think you just, like, by saying what you said, just put out the perfect example of just how the ego works in general. Like, I get the message, it comes in through intuition. I'm going to serve this medicine, right? And then the ego comes in and it's like, no, no, you're not. Who are you? You're not good enough. You're not worthy enough. And, like, don't tell anybody, you know, and, like, that's what the ego always does. And then people, we have a hard time, like, rising into who we really are because the ego will try to bring us down. But, yeah, at that time, like, I wasn't super empowered as a woman yet and very secure in myself and who I was. Like, I was, you know, halfway through my medicine path at that point and helping, and, like, people looked up to me, but, like, you know, my growth really came actually from my deeper work with the toad. But I think that that voice of the ego is going to show up, like, anytime we try to step up, yeah. You know, that's what it does. And when you can recognize it, you don't have to listen to it. Like, in that scenario, I definitely was not ready yet in that moment. Like, I got that hit and I still had a lot of work to do. And it was a good year and a half or so before I ever did end up serving it. But, like, you know, it was in my heart at that moment. Yeah. And I think that was the gift of the medicine and the gift of intuition. It was like, okay, I felt it. And I knew that was something that felt like I was going to do and that I wanted to do. And I had to now spend the next whatever amount of time finding out who I was, discovering my self-worth, becoming secure in myself, you know, learning who I was so that I could actually go and serve it. So it actually showed me the work.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'd love to hear more about that. And again, here's just sort of another parallel that, because from that first experience for me, what it left me with was, I'm not certain who I am anymore as a person, as an individual, as whoever this character of Martin is. I'm not sure who that is anymore. And one of the routes that I took was like, okay, so I want to tell everyone about this, you know, and just my podcast at that point pretty much became devoted to sharing as much as I could about 5-MeO. So this is back in 2008. And, you know, maybe if I had some, I might have started serving it, but that didn't come till about a year and a half later, right? Another parallel. Here's just where there's an opposite, that I took this approach of, okay, I want to tell everyone about this. I want to educate them about it. I want to tell them why this is so special. And, you know, rather than, well, I'm just going to keep it to myself. I don't know who to tell. But even in doing that, the pushback was tremendous in the psychedelic community, because I got out there and I started saying, look, nothing compares to this. I don't care what you've experienced before. If you haven't experienced 5-MeO-DMT, you haven't experienced this. And even DMT pretty much pales by comparison. And the general attitude among the psychedelic community at that time was, who the fuck are you to say something like that? Mm. So there was a lot of anger and resentment and pushback on that. Wow. So it wasn't like people were just receiving this and like, oh, wow, tell me more about this, what you've now called the God molecule. Tell me more about that. It was more like, who the fuck do you think you are?
Yeah.
Saying things like this.
Right, which I'm like, that might be another parallel for us by the time I share the rest of my story on the podcast.
Yeah. So you decided to keep it to yourself, though, and we're eager to return.
Each knew that I was working with this medicine. I was still working with the other medicines, but, like, and I would talk about it, like, you should try it, but I wasn't sharing my call to serve.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So then, in returning back to the medicine, going back for more, what was your process like?
Yeah, shortly after that, I had an experience that I'll never forget, that all the message was just, it was God, like, why won't you let me in? Mm. And I didn't know what to do with that at that time. The person serving me didn't offer integration. So like I would have my experience and do the best that I could with it on my own. And I was like, haha, God said, why don't you let me in? You know, that's funny. Like looking back, I'm like, gosh, I could have done so much with that had I known better or someone was there to support me in the experience. And after not working with that person anymore and finding somebody else, I had like the first super, super profound pivotal experience, and I just wept and wept and wept. It was like a lock and a key went together. Like everything I'd been looking for my whole life, I was feeling like everything, like so much love, me as my own soulmate, all the safety, security, stability, just everything in this one feeling. And I was just crying my eyes out. It was so beautiful. And like that journey changed everything. And within a couple, maybe like even 6 weeks to 2 months, I was at my training to learn how to serve it.
Wow.
Yeah. So that came later down the road. It was a lot of like healing old marriage stuff. Like I had a lot of tight jaw stuff and, you know, just getting through the nitty gritties of the energetics of my body before it really showed me that pivotal experience that this medicine could offer. And, but the timing was all perfect because it was like, I was ready then, way more ready to go and embark on a very big journey.
Yeah. Well, I love that you even mentioned like tightness in your jaw, that it's one of these interesting things of when we continue to work with whatever our chosen medicine is, that often I find that it goes into more of these sort of fine tuning things where it's like, oh, I'm just experiencing all this tightness in my jaw. I'm not having like this amazing, profound experience, but like all this energy is here and something's working out here. And I think that that's where so much of the important work gets done, that there's so much promotion of the idea of big breakthroughs and big revelations, but sometimes it is like, why am I clenching my jaw?
Mm-hmm. And that's
going on?
Huge. It's like, this is the first time in my life that I'm not in excruciating chronic pain in my jaw, and I can recognize when it's tense or relaxed and I'm able to relax it. Yeah. And a lot of my work was, why am I trying to control everything? Because that's what the jaw is, you know, and it's like the stop gap in between the energy. So yeah, there was just like that attunement period of all these energetic things in my body having, you know, working its way through.
Yeah. And the way that we brace for reality in different parts of our body. You know, some people it's the jaw, some people it might be the hands, others it might be the abdomen, or it could be the back, whatever it is, people brace, that we put out our projections and our expectations and our desires, and then we encounter resistance and then, oh, we're holding on to it or whatever. But rather than being sort of that open conduit of, okay, I'm clear in my intentions, I'm clear in my desires, I'm clear with my energy, I'm able to process what I receive from others, but I'm not holding on to it, and having that openness and fluidity, that's where the medicine can bring us if we work with it long enough.
And that's what being present is having the openness and fluidity, and like a good sign to know that if you are in the future or thinking of something else or anxious or whatever, is your body will tell you, because it's bracing for something that hasn't happened. Because if you're braced, but you're like in your home relaxing, you know, and that can also be a trauma pattern too that needs to get worked out. But yeah, what's there to brace for?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then in actually turning to training, how did that develop for you? Because this is a question that comes up for a lot of people, to say, look, I'm interested, I want to serve, I want to be trained, but like finding the right person and actually finding training, that's a whole nother question. So how did that work for you?
Yeah, you know, I had asked around for a bit for other people I knew who served Toad and also who served ayahuasca. And I was trying to find somewhere to go, someone who would recommend, and nothing was coming through. So I got online and Googled Bufo facilitator training, and I found a place in Mexico, and it was like a 16-day, very intensive. This was what it said, 16-day, very intensive. Our deepest program, you know, combo as well. And I'm like, let me get on a call with him. And we got on a call and talked. And I was like, okay, this feels right. And it was just like, book it. So I booked it. I got on the phone with the co-parent. Everything aligned perfectly. I'm like, here I am. Here I go. And then I was like, oh my God, what have I done? Like, I can't believe that I'm going to go to a BUFO facilitator training from something that I found online and I didn't get a recommendation. And I got really nervous about it and like almost pulled out shortly before going, and like even had some friends who also served the medicine be like, how did you find this? And just be like, I don't know. It's a lot of medicine there. Like, why do you have to work with so much medicine? And, but you know what? It was the perfect program for me. So it was like another time to be like, I could trust myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what constituted the program? And you don't need to give us all the details, but I'm just curious, like, what was the trajectory during that intensive time period?
The trajectory was me showing up with a lot of ego and thinking I knew a lot of things already and thinking that I was going to be trained to learn how to serve. And, what I really realized was I went there to really understand what God is, but I didn't know that, and they don't market it that way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was like, wow. And then I realized the work around BUFO was completely different than I had thought. And like through the messages and the healing that were happening there. And we did a lot of medicine, you know, every day, and also other medicines in addition to it. Combo, psilocybin, and then some DMT with Syrian rue ceremonies that, you know, and it's a very big push, very fast, like eating minimal, a lot of fruit. I fasted for 3 days. I mean, everything I could to break down my mind, like as much as possible so that I could surrender. And like, they just want to get you there. And I was just like, yeah, from the second I showed up, I just realized like I had this big safety thing within myself to find, and, you know, a mistrust piece happening. And these were things that were just blocking me. And I was like associating God with a male and mistrusting men, just like seeing things I'd never seen before. And it was through one of the journeys, I was like, wow, the work with BUFOs to help people discover their true authentic self. And I was like, what? This is way bigger than I could have ever imagined. Yeah. And I was like, I'm just the perfect person for the job.
So if you were to characterize yourself prior to going in and then coming out, where do you think the biggest shifts or changes were for you in that program?
I think I came out much more myself. Hmm. Instead of coming back, like, oh, you're a different person. It's like, no, I'm more myself. I like shed all the layers of things that were not who I even was. You know, I think in my first journey there, I remember coming out and looking at my teacher in the eyes, and he was like, phew. And I was like, what? Mm-hmm. He's like, you know, that's your responsibility. And I was like, it is? Because I saw all the patterns and programming I was running and all rules and restrictions and regulations and like all the boxes and like everything that I was living in, like this huge like confinement of life. And we just looked at each other like, oh my goodness. And that was like the first time I think I realized too, I had to take responsibility for that. So like I came home much freer. I was able to be in the flow in a way I had never been able to be in the flow before I left, and understand a presence of God in myself, of us. Often I'll just be like, we or us, that I didn't know about before. And I talked about God nonstop. Yeah, my friends would be like, when you're bringing that up, you're really triggering me. And I'm like, great, let's look at it together.
Yeah. Oh, that's so great because I mean that's what I was doing back in 2008, and like so many people came to me as like, we'd really like you if you just used a different word. And I was like, okay, so what's your problem with it then? Like, I understand this is triggering for you, but this is an authentic word for me. And
Right.
I had had my own hangups around the word God, you know, and when they dropped away from me, then I noticed, oh, everybody else has got these same hangups that I used to have, but it was me getting in the way of, as you say, being and knowing myself. And that as a shorthand term, God, it really worked. And the fact that it does trigger people, that it should trigger people, that if you tell people, oh, well, 5-MeO-DMT will help you encounter your authentic self. I mean, that's so new agey, that's so psychobabble safe, you know, and that we have these nice, warm, cozy ideas of what the authentic self is. And you know, we might equate that with drinking a glass of wine in the evening because I'm living my best life or something. But you know, that's not it at all. It's actually this kind of hard confrontation of, look at all the fucking programs you put into yourself that you chose that are limiting who and what you actually are as this embodiment of this universal being of unconditional love. Like, that's a big responsibility.
It's huge responsibility. No wonder nobody wants to believe
Yeah.
it. Yeah, and that we have this like in so much co-creative power in that. Yeah.
Yeah. So coming home from that, then what did you decide to create?
I came home and shortly realized all the places in my life that I was being inauthentic. And then I was no longer willing to show up that way anymore. And I was part of like this business group every week that we'd meet with, and they didn't really know about my deeper work with medicine. They kind of, I thought like I was just like the spiritual business person. And I was like, I never could go back to the meeting again. So I exited out of that. I came home and it felt like my life was falling apart in front of my eyes, which was what was happening. But it's really falling apart to come back together. And then it was like, I'm gonna close my business. And I slowly started shutting my business down. And I was supposed to go to an ayahuasca ceremony, and I was like, I can't be going to this ayahuasca ceremony. And I gifted it to a girlfriend, and I spent the weekend alone at home in my house because I had just done so much medicine that I needed. It was like challenging to be out energetically for me. So I like hunkered down. Kids were out of town. And I'm like, what do you want me to do? Like, here I am. We've gotten me this far. Like, what's my service? Because that's what the work is. How do you want me to share and serve? And like through that time, like this 3-month program downloaded down. And I put it together, and like I didn't even have it together yet. And if someone stops by and I'm like just sharing, she's like, I'll sign up. And like just like that, in that one moment, like the program got created, and like instantaneously I had a client. And I did a 3-month program, and I'm like trying to remember if I remember how cute it was. It doesn't matter. It was 3 months of like looking into all of your stuff, healing it, and coming into who you actually are. And I had served would serve bufo to them each month at the beginning, and then we would have calls every week to talk about what was going on. So I was doing that for a little bit, and I was also, well, I did that throughout the whole time that I served, and then I also was serving people, serving people who would come to me. But I more wanted to do a deeper work and help people get to God and not just offer an experience to somebody. Like I was more interested in someone who had done their work, who was still not breaking through, and I felt like that was my client who was ready to find out who they really were.
Yeah, so it kind of sounds like you're working with two fundamentally different groups of people. One would be the people who are actually going through the program, and that sounds like that was individual for each person. So you're
It
working one-on-one with them, and then
was,
also serving people who are looking for that breakthrough, looking for that moment of progress, and you're doing some assessment there to see who you feel would be ready for that.
if they're ready, if we're a good fit, it would kind of be like, I could serve them once. If it feels right, they could come into the program to do the deeper work. Cause often they want to come back and it's like, well, if you want to come back, this is how we can work together. And it was great. It was great growth for me. It was beautiful to watch the transformations, of my clients and the things that they created and the blocks that they overcame. And I worked with women like all the way up into their 60s and 65. And like, it was like a core group of women that I worked with in that age range. And what I learned during that time is like, no matter how old you are or whatever gender or age you are, like you have to heal specific things. And if you don't do it when you're 30 or 40 or 50, you're going to do it when you're 60. It has to be healed at some point.
Yeah. Well, I guess I would say maybe it doesn't have
to
be.
If you choose to.
But if you want to come into that more authentic expression of the self, you've got to deal with the shit.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you probably agree with this. As long as we're alive, you've still got time.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
You're never too late. It's never too old. You're never too old. Yeah.
Yeah. Where sometimes people, even that becomes a self-limiting imposition that they put on themselves. Like, well, my time has passed or it's too late for me.
You're still alive.
Yeah. So that sounds like that was rewarding work for the time that you were doing it.
It was rewarding. You know, I think it was shortly after that that I found you, that I needed some help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, how do you feel about the progress that your clients were making in terms of their sense of self-satisfaction, their sense of transformation? In other words, were people getting out of it what they were hoping to get out of it? Or what's your assessment of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think as a leader in whatever capacity you're leading people in is you can generally lead them only as far as you have gotten. And I think I was able to lead everyone as far as I had gotten and help them create new things in their business, find purposes, discover limiting beliefs, realize why they didn't feel safe and they were trying to control, why they were so scared of running out of money, just like the nitty gritties of all the different fears that a lot of us run throughout our lifetime. And like that, a lot of the people that I worked with, which was such a reflection for me, were very controlling personalities. Because when you serve somebody, the healing is always mutual. Like they have something for you just as you're there to help them, you know? So, seeing a lot of control and all the ways that everybody wanted to control and what was underneath that. Why didn't they feel safe? You know, why couldn't they trust? Why couldn't they be in the flow? It was getting into that stuff, which is like, it's deep under the hood.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so interesting how this phenomenon of where you can see yourself within the patterns of the client. And even if it's not something you personally identify with, you know, the more you understand the way that the ego works and the ways that we fuck with ourselves, that you recognize that more easily. You notice like, okay, well, that might not be my pattern, but I can see the ego. I know what's going on there because I know how that's this same kind of thing has worked within myself. And as you say, that as they transform and heal, we transform and heal those things within ourselves as facilitators, that it becomes this combined experience. And I think that in particular that 5-MeO is a very powerful vehicle for that because it does dissolve these boundaries in a very powerful way where, you know, we go into these shared experiences that, you know, I've often said that when you're really facilitating with 5-MeO and working with your clients, it's an incredibly intimate experience in a way that's uncanny even.
It's so vulnerable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.